"You have to find Levi," she cried. "Right now, find him and stop him." I asked her why and where is he and what is he about to do. And she said there wasn't time, that I needed to call Ian and ask him to find Levi before he killed Coop. "Why does Levi want to kill Coop?" I asked her. But she walked away from me and started to pace and then beg and plead. "Just call Ian right now. Please, Charlie. He'll do it for you. I know he will." I took out my phone and called Ian and told him I didn't know what was going on, but could he start looking in all the places Levi might go to find Clay Cooper? His stores, his house, the warehouse where he holds his illegal poker games. "Just look for his car and look for Levi's car and keep calling Levi until he answers." Ian agreed, just like Keller said he would. "Okay," I said to Keller, coaxing her to the table with her drink and her cigarette. I got some ice from the freezer and put it in the towel and made her hold it against her face, which was starting to swell. "Can you tell me what happened?" I asked her. Then she took a long, shaky breath, then a drink, then a drag. "You know about what Coop does, right? How he tries to date us, the girls who work for him. And if we do, we get better hours and bonuses. And if we don't, we get fewer hours and the worst shifts, enough to hurt us, but not enough to get him in real trouble." I nodded. I didn't tell her how I knew, how I'd seen Coop at the Marriott Hotel with the girl from the diner. Keller went on, her body seeming to calm as she reconstructed the story piece by piece so it became a clear picture, not just an emotional tornado that I saw spinning behind her eyes. "He started asking me the day I turned 18, and I told him no, and not just once, over and over. He never stopped asking. And you saw how he cut back my shifts or made them all conflict, so I had to choose between the diner and the Triple S. I told him no, over and over, even though I couldn't stop him from looking and touching, and it made me sick. I know, Keller, I know. And then today, he told me he had a new job for me. He said his friend who managed the Marriott was looking for a hostess at the restaurant and that I should go for an interview and wear something grown up so I looked attractive for all the businessmen who stayed there from out of town. He sounded sincere, like he really wanted to help me. He sounded nice for a change, and I believed him. I'm so stupid, Charlie, so stupid." She stopped herself from crying again with a drink and a drag, and then looked at the burning cigarette and the long piece of ash that hung on its edge. "I waited a long time for the manager, over an hour. I sat at the bar with a Shirley Temple because that's all they could serve me, and they were nice to even let me sit there at all. And then all of a sudden, I heard his voice say hello." "The manager?" I asked, because I was still a stupid idiot. "No," she said, shaking her head. "Not the manager." Suddenly, I got it. The whole scene. The whole picture. It had all been a setup. "Oh!" Keller nodded. "It was Coop! And he sat down and ordered a drink. I asked him what was going on and where was the manager. Was he meeting us later? Was Coop going to introduce us? And you know what he did?" I did know, but I let her tell it. "He laughed. That horrible laugh he makes when he wants to humiliate us. The way he laughed when he called Janice's son Half Pint. That kind of laugh. And he said, 'Why do you need another job when you already have two jobs working for me?' And I said, 'Because you keep cutting back my hours and I can't pay the rent and take care of my grandmother.' And he made this
this fake pity face, and I wanted to punch him right on his nose.
What did you do?
My heart was pounding with sheer hatred.
I swallowed it all down.
And then I asked him why I was here. And he said,
"So I can show you that it's really not so bad to go out with me, see?" He said, "Look how nice this place is.
And they have good food. And I can even sneak you a cocktail if we sit at a table. And all we have to do is have dinner. That's all. Just dinner. You see? Is it really so bad?"
Another sip and another drag. And then she started to cry. And I was suddenly hoping Ian wouldn't find Levi in time, and that Levi would pound Coop's face right into the ground.
"So what did you do?" I asked.
She started to laugh, but it wasn't a normal laugh. It was a laugh that people make when they can't cry anymore.
"I lost my shit, Charlie. I ran out of the restaurant and even took off my shoes because they were slowing me down. And I kept running barefoot through the lobby and out to the parking lot and got in my car and locked the doors and drove a few miles down the road until I realized I was in no shape to drive. So I pulled over and then I did something even more stupid than anything else that night. I called Levi."
Keller said that he calmed her down and then talked to her the whole time she drove home. He didn't want her to wait for him to get her, because what if Coop drove past her on the interstate or some other creep? She had to keep moving. And while she was driving home, Levi went to her house. Dot let him in, and she was lucid and watching her shows on the TV. Soaps all day, game shows all night, the usual. Keller recorded them on the DVR. She had to make sure they were new episodes because Dot wouldn't watch anything twice. Even when she couldn't remember that Keller was Keller and not her mother, she could remember whether she'd seen an episode of one of her shows, and it would send her into a rage. I had no idea before tonight what those rages really looked like, that those rages had been causing all the bruises. But Levi did. So when he got there, he went inside and made sure Dot was lucid and calm while he waited for Keller. And when he saw her car pull in the driveway, he ran outside and met her at the door, and she fell into his arms.
"He picked me up, Charlie, just like I was a little girl, like I weighed nothing. He picked me up and carried me into the house and put me down on the sofa next to Dot's chair, and they both looked at me, and they both thought things because of the way I was dressed and my hair and the makeup that was running down my face and because I wasn't wearing any shoes."
I could picture it as I sat there looking at Keller's face and her bare legs that were crossed in the chair because the tube dress was so short and so tight. And even after I'd cleaned off what I could with the towel from the sink, the mascara was smeared all around her eyes.
Something went off inside Dot, and she started screaming at me about being a whore, but not because she thought I was my mom, but because she thought I was a whore. The real me. Even if all I'd done was try to get a new job where men like to look at you while you walk them to their table.
She sighed, and I waited. And then she continued.
Levi started pacing around the room like a wild animal, asking me all kinds of questions. Was there even a job? Was it all a setup? And did I consider it? Did I think about having dinner with Coop to get more hours at the diner in the Triple S? He was getting louder and crazier. So loud and crazy that Dot shut up and sat perfectly still in her chair because we both felt it, how Levi was about to explode. I tried to tell him that of course I didn't stay, that I left. And Levi said it didn't matter.
It was still wrong. Still a betrayal. Because I didn't tell him I was going there in the first place. Levi finally did explode. He didn't stay to comfort Keller. He didn't stay to make sure she was safe from Dot. He just stared at me like I had mortally wounded him because of something Coop had done. Like maybe I was responsible for getting the idea in his head. Like maybe I had led him on. And look at my clothes and makeup. What was Coop supposed to think? So when he turned and left and his car peeled away from the curb, I knew where he was going and what he was planning to do. Before he left, Charlie, right before, he said he never wanted to see me ever again. She broke down after she told me this, head in her hands, hands between her knees, sobs and heaves of breath and just wrenching despair that I could not stand for. Not in Keller. This was not how her story would end. "Come on," I told her. "Let's get you changed. I'll take care of Levi." I grabbed the phone again, and this time I didn't just check to see if Ian had found Levi. I had the power to do something. I had the ability to stop this. I dialed and waited just two rings before Coop picked up. Chapter 34.
Hello, Charlie.
Agent Selman? How did you get in here?
The door was open.
But I locked it. And the alarm was on.
Oh, was it? You must have forgotten. You're in a panic, Charlie. Sometimes, when that happens, we don't remember things. Short-term memory is lost. But it's okay. Because I'm here now. You're safe.
Okay. Did you find the office? With the blood? Did you find the dead lawyer?
We saw the office with the blood. And yes, Charlie, we did find Daryl Romanski. I'm so sorry to have to tell you this. Please try not to get too upset. But we found her body. It was in the dumpster behind the building. They shot her.
Oh my God, I knew it. I knew they killed her.
It's all right, Charlie. It'll be all right.
But why? I don't understand. Wasn't she working for them? To trick me into giving her the things from the safe?
I don't know what happened, Charlie. You know, these people, it's like I said about dog eat dog. Loyalty breaking down, anything could have happened. A fight over how to split the money once they found it, or maybe she was double-crossing them. We'll probably never untangle it all.
But now they have no way of getting the money. It doesn't make sense.
I agree. But what we do know is that you have what they want. And they know how to get to you, with or without that woman pretending to be your lawyer. Which means you are in terrible danger. We need to bring you in. Right now. And you need to give us everything you have to use against these butchers. The cell phone, what was in the safe, and anything else you can think of about the inventory and sales numbers. We have to build a case to put them in jail where they can't hurt you or the people you care about.
But what if there's nothing you can use? What if all of that evidence isn't evidence of anything? Just money hidden somewhere. The money on its own doesn't prove a crime was committed. Money is just paper.
I know. You want to help figure this all out, Charlie? But let us worry about building our case. This is what we do. And believe me, we have plenty of evidence already in place to arrest Barry and his team. And now we have a murder. Maybe two murders if they killed Clay Cooper and we can prove it. Now, I just need you to give me what you have and let me bring you in so I can keep you safe. Now, Charlie, we don't have much time.
Wait. I have more questions.
Like what?
Like, how come you always work alone? Where's your team? Don't you have a partner, at least? And what if Barry was following me and he's outside this house right now? Wouldn't he just kill us both?
The team is outside, Charlie. Look, we know what we're doing. And I always meet you alone because I thought it might be too intimidating if I brought my team. Or even my partner. I didn't want to scare you. I promise. I have answers for all of your questions, but right now is not the time. What's that?
That's the alarm. I told you I said it.
Who has the key to get in?
Dusty, but he's away with my brothers and my mom, but she's at the hairdresser. She shouldn't be home for hours.
Charlie? What's going on? Where are you?
Mom? Why are you back so early?
You wouldn't believe it. The girl who does my color was out today, and the others don't know what they're doing, so I just got up and left. My hair's soaking wet, and there you are. Wait. Who is this man in my house?
Mom, don't.
What the? Ward Harlow?
Chapter 35. The Night of the Murder. Coop was easy to lure in. He picked up on the second ring, and when I told him that I needed to see him right then, that night, he was curious in a disgusting way, because it meant I needed something from him. And when you needed something from Coop, that's when he could make you give him something in return, even if that something was nothing more than your dignity. His two hands, one giving and the other taking. Rule 3 about people being predictable. Rule 24 about good and evil. It was no surprise that Coop said he would meet me at the SSS in half an hour. Levi had been chasing his tail, stopping at all the same places, but missing Coop here and there. Which is why they say to children, if you ever get lost, stand still and someone will find you. I still had Tracy's car, and he was stuck at the store, already past closing, and pissed off at me because he had a party to get to. When I pulled into the parking lot, Coop wasn't there yet. It was just Tracy, so I parked, went inside, quickly helped Tracy close up, and rode off on my bike before him so he saw I was leaving. I didn't want anyone to know I was meeting Coop, alone, after hours, because rumors would start and then they would spread, and I needed to just go to college and not become the talk of the town. I circled back around the shop and waited for Coop. He got there just past 10:30. He drives a silver pickup truck with a special container in the back to hold animals he kills when he goes hunting. And he has a rack for his shotgun, which he sometimes keeps there and sometimes doesn't, because he's always afraid someone will break in, steal the shotgun, and kill someone. And then he would somehow get framed for the murder, because that's the kind of world we live in. I watched him pull in and park. I watched the lights go on in the store. I checked my phone one last time and even tried to call Ian, but he didn't answer. I almost texted Ian about where I was, but I really, really didn't want anyone to know where I was and who I was with. The whole idea of it made me sick, and I hadn't even gotten off my bike yet. The back door was open, and I went inside. Coop was in the office, sitting at his desk. He was agitated, and that was not a good thing. "Charlie Hudson," he said, seeing me there, still in my jeans and SSS t-shirt from the dinner shift. He slid out of his chair and walked to where I was standing in the prep room between the two metal tables. He stood too close, which was something he liked to do, but it felt even worse when we were alone. And I realized that in all the years I had worked for Clay Cooper, I had never been with him like this, alone. He tilted his head and smiled. He said nothing about Keller, because he had no idea she was my best friend and had probably told me what had happened at the Marriott. He knew next to nothing about any of us, even though he saw us every day, because nothing mattered beyond what he wanted from us.
He didn't care about Keller's grandmother or the bruises or about me wanting to go to college or about my spreadsheets and how I kept the inventory and stocked the refrigerator units and that I was good with numbers. Very good. So, what's going on, huh? Where's the fire? I had the story worked out in my head. What I needed to say to make Coop interested and engaged so he would stay here long enough for Ian to find Levi. I had my phone on vibrate inside my back pocket so I would know if he texted or called and I could get the hell out of there and away from Coop. It would have been far easier to tell him the truth, that Levi wanted to beat him to a dead, bloody pulp. But then he might have welcomed that challenge. He might have found Levi himself and asked for the fight and then gotten Levi arrested. Nothing would have made him happier, and he would have taken a beating to see that happen. So, I lied. I've been saving money for college. Coop leaned against one of the prep tables and crossed his arms. A creepy smile began to form in one corner of his mouth when he nodded. Well, I continued, I'm already working as many hours as I can here without missing school. Coop let out a little moan, like an aha, I'm starting to understand sort of thing. I can get some money in federal loans, I tell him, killing time. But for other loans, I need a cosigner. And my mom can't do it because she doesn't have anything in her name. And my stepfather, Dusty, well, Coop jumped in at the mention of Dusty's name. He's a cheap prick, right? I always knew it. Lawyers, they're all the same, every last one of them. So, go on. I told him that if he co-signed a loan for me 1 year, I would promise to come back and work every summer, and that I would use that money to pay down the loan and blah, blah, blah. I went on and on because none of this was real. I would never ask Clay Cooper for a favor. Never. Coop looked me up and down, then shook his head.
Follow me, he said.
He led us into the office and bent over to where the safe is kept under the desk, and he opened it. His breathing was heavy with agitation. I'd seen him like that before. Once, when a customer complained about his sandwich and wanted a refund. Once, when he caught Levi and Keller making out in the parking lot on her break. Once, when Nora showed him the Excel models. The list was pretty long, actually, so I stopped thinking about it. When he stood up and faced me, he was holding a large handful of bills.
You need money for college, Charlie?
Money like this? He shoved the pile of bills right up to my nose. Smell that, Charlie. That's what money smells like. Real money. Cash money. It smelled disgusting, like must in an old, grimy closet. But I kept a straight face. When I turned my head to the side, he yelled at me to smell it, Charlie. So I sniffed in the smell of the bills and winced. That's right. It smells bad, doesn't it? It's dirty, and it smells dirty. Because thousands, maybe even millions, of human hands have touched it and handled it, and human hands are filthy dirty. Everyone talks about crisp, clean bills, but money isn't like that for men like me. Maybe for a banker who gets his money right off the press, but for the rest of us, it's like this. It's filthy. But it doesn't matter. Because my filthy dollar is just as valuable as that asshole banker's crisp new dollar. So screw him. He took the money away from my face and looked at it while he went on and on about how you had to be smart and avoid taxes. Taxes and taxes and taxes. Payroll taxes. Social Security taxes. Unemployment insurance taxes. Medicaid taxes. Every one of those filthy dollars would be cut in half. But he was smarter than that. He stepped closer to me,
his face again becoming playful but aggressive.
You're still a girl, aren't you, Charlie?
His eyes traveled to right smack between my legs.
You are, aren't you?
I felt my face turn bright red with embarrassment, and then the heat came.
It's important to know what your assets are, Charlie, and how you can monetize them. Do you know what that means? It means to get money for something. Money for the things you have that people want.
I didn't answer. I knew about monetization from my economics class, duh. But then he went on, telling me about what men paid for nice girls like me.
You need money for college? All you have to do is go on the internet with that innocent face of yours and name your price. I bet you'll get 2 years tuition for one go.
It took me a second to realize what he was saying. And when I did, I looked at him with disgust because Coop had never looked as dirty as he did right then. I didn't say a word as I backed away from him. Coop followed me, his face beaming with agitation and the sweat running from the bald spot down the sides of his face.
Girls give it up for a smile in gym class, for a date to the prom, for a moment of feeling important. Such a waste. Some schmuck would pay your college tuition, Charlie, for one night. And you girls all complain about not having any power.
This was one of those times when it was good to be a girl people don't understand, because I forced the disgust off my face and replaced it with a smile and said I needed to use the bathroom. And then I walked and didn't even run, even though I felt like running. I had never been afraid of Coop. Not really. But tonight he was agitated and talking about men paying me for one go. And I started to wonder if it really was good to be a girl like me right then. Because who would ever believe me if Coop suddenly lost his shit and decided to take from me what Keller wouldn't give him? I went into the bathroom and locked the door. I needed time. I needed to know what was going on with Levi. I needed to know if I could leave, and then I needed a plan to get out. I ran cold water and cupped my hands to catch it and pressed it into my face. I took a long, deep breath and told myself it was almost over. I just had to make sure Levi was safe and then make it out that back door. I had no idea that this was just the beginning.
Chapter 36.
Ward Harlow? Is that you? What are you doing here? Hey, what are you doing in my house? With my daughter?
What are you talking about, Mom? This is Agent Zellman with the FBI. He was asking me about Coop's murder, that's all.
Zellman? FBI? That's Ward Harlow from Sawyer High. He was in the same class with Coop and Cullen McGuire.
But he's with the FBI. I saw his badge, and Ian checked it out.
That can't be right. Ward
Mom,
is...
Mom, listen to me. Coop was involved in some bad things, and Agent Zellman has been trying to find out what his employees saw. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. Who is this man you think I look like?
His name is Ward Harlow. I haven't seen him since high school, but still... The resemblance is uncanny.
Well, they say we all have doppelgangers out there.
I hope this doesn't sound rude, but I'm not really comfortable with any of this. You shouldn't be in my home alone with my daughter. I don't care who you are. She's a lawyer, you know. And how do I even know that you are who you say you are? I'm going to call Dusty and have his office verify your credentials, and then I'm calling Charlie's lawyer. It won't take long. We can go in the kitchen and have some coffee if you want.
Eileen, put the phone down.
How do you know my name? Is that a gun? Are you seriously pointing a gun at me in my own home? Charlie, what's going on?
Mom, just do what he says. Please, I was trying to warn you.
And why does your gun have a silencer? Cops don't use those. FBI agents don't use those. I can't think of one time I've seen it on TV. And they do their research.
Don't get that, Charlie. And Eileen, same goes for you. No one touches a phone.
But it's probably Ian, because I left him a message earlier, and he's probably...
And if she doesn't pick up, he'll know something's wrong, and he'll be here in a split second. In fact, he's probably here right now, outside this house, with the entire police squad.
Both of you, slide the phones over to me, across the floor. Come on, both of them. Okay, then. That wasn't so hard, was it? And I don't see any cop cars out there, Eileen. You know, you used to be smart. A little naive, maybe, letting that teacher get his way with you, but smart. That's what happens in Sawyer. Nowhere to go but down. Now, Charlie, let's get back to what we were discussing. You were about to give me the cell phone and the things from Coop's safe, remember?
They're upstairs, in my room.
Let's go.
Charlie, don't you move. You're not going anywhere with this piece of garbage.
Oh, I'm sorry you feel that way.
Please, no!
Don't shoot!
Don't shoot!
Oh my
God. Mom!
She has about 15 minutes before she bleeds out. Better get moving.
Chapter 37, The Night of the Murder. I was about to give up on finding Levi. I was about to leave the bathroom and make my escape past Coop and his wad of cash when I felt my phone vibrate in my back pocket. It was Ian calling. "Do you have him?" I asked. "Did you find Levi?"
"Charlie."
Ian could hardly speak. He was driving, that much I could tell, but his voice was shaking. He might have even been crying. What? What happened? I leaned against the edge of the sink, staring at the tiles on the floor, which were dirty because lazy Tracy could never do a damned thing he was told.
"I found it. I found the car."
"Levi's car?"
"No, no. The car. The orange Buick LeSabre, the car that killed my father."
"What? Where is it? Where are you right now?"
"Coop has it, Charlie, which means Coop was driving it and has hidden it all these years right here, right under our noses."
I was speechless then, staring at the dirty tiles, my butt against the sink.
"How? Where?"
I heard Ian draw a long, deep breath so he could tell me what had happened. "I went out to the warehouse where Coop has those poker games. I was looking for Levi, like you asked. There were no cars and it was dark, but I got out to make sure in case Levi had come and gone. I walked the perimeter, checked inside through the windows, but there was nothing, no one. And then, as I was heading back, I noticed this old garage through some trees with a small access road. So I thought maybe that's where he holds the games, or maybe something else, I don't know. I went back there, flashed my light through a small window on the side, and there it was, Charlie. After all these years, there was the orange Buick. The car that killed my father."
I didn't know what to say. So I said the dumbest, most obvious thing.
"Are you sure?
Tell me the VIN number. I wrote it down. Tell me. Do you have the one from the car that was stolen?"
"Hold on." I opened the notes app on my phone where I keep important things. Like this. XPG749TYW8643PL97, I tell him.
"That's it! That's the one on the car in Coop's garage! And there was a dent along the hood and scraped paint and..."
"There's something else, Charlie."
"What is it?" I couldn't be sure, but it looked like he hit my father dead on. Not from the side, not like he was trying to swerve to miss him, but head on, like he wanted to kill him. My heart was back in my throat. I heard Coop calling for me. Then I heard a car pulling into the lot, and I peeked out the door in time to see the flash of red, the taillights passing. "Where's Levi?" I asked Ian, stepping back into the bathroom so Coop couldn't hear me, but there was no answer. "Ian?" I said his name over and over, louder and louder. "Ian!" There was no answer. The call was disconnected. And now someone was here after closing. Levi was missing, on a quest to find Coop, maybe even to kill him. Coop was in the back of the store with the door unlocked. And I was here, in the bathroom, like a scared little mouse. Time passed. I can't say how long, because I was frozen, staring at my phone, willing it to ring. I needed to hear the end of Ian's story. But then I remembered about Coop waiting and being agitated, and I knew I had to just get out of there any way I could and worry about Ian and Levi later. I devised a plan using rule number 6. People are easily distracted. I would distract Coop by talking about Keller as I moved slowly around him toward the exit. I opened the bathroom door and began to walk back toward the service area. And that's when I heard the sound that had me scrambling to hide beneath the counter. I hid there and listened to the fighting. Fists punching and things crashing from shelves, and then the sound of a metal tomato slicer on a skull, which I would only identify later when I saw it. It was the sharp corner that hit Coop's head, crushing it, smashing it in deep and with such force that Coop fell over onto the metal table and began to bleed until he was dead. Chapter 38. Now. Mom! Mommy!
I scream and lunge toward them, Ward with his gun still pointed down and my mom lying on the ground, not moving. I haven't called her mommy since I was a little girl, since before we ran from that house in the middle of the night, but that is the word that leaves my mouth in this moment. Ward turns the gun at me. 15 minutes before she dies. What are you gonna do, Charlie? It was in that moment that I understood myself more than ever before. I could feel emotions taking over, my hot head making me freeze like I did in the car that night when Agent Selman surprised me, shocked me. The analytical part was retreating, shrinking back, away from the heat. I look at my mom lying on the floor, bleeding, dying, because of me, because I brought Ward here, and because she tried to save my life. I'd put it all together on the way back from the pool of blood at my fake lawyer's office, as I was pedaling faster and faster to get to this house and finish what I started. Rule number 0, the golden rule, trust no one. I went through the list of things that didn't add up, things I could use to prove Zelman couldn't be trusted. First, his car keys hung on a budget rent-a-car chain. What kind of FBI agent rents a car from Budget? Second, he smells of cigarettes and alcohol, and what kind of FBI agent smells like that, especially on duty? Third, he doesn't have a partner, and he only has one set of clothes. Fourth, his story doesn't add up. Coop didn't pretend to sell more sandwiches and cigarettes. He didn't pretend to order more inventory. And he didn't pretend to rent more apartments. Agent Zelman told me that Coop inflated all of those things to clean the cash Barry gave him. Barry, this criminal from the city. But Coop didn't inflate those things. He deflated them. I know exactly how many sandwiches we sell and how much inventory we buy because Nora and I keep track and we put it into the spreadsheets that she keeps on her thumb drive so that we can be efficient, in spite of Coop's refusal to keep any records. I remember enough. The ledgers Coop wrote down and the actual numbers from the register and the invoices for food. It was on Nora's thumb drive, but it was all in my head too. Coop wasn't involved in any money laundering scheme. He was selling sandwiches and tobacco and food at his diner for cash and renting apartments for cash so he could take the cash and put it somewhere safe where he would never have to pay taxes on it or risk having it in a bank or the stock market or have anything to do with the government in any way. Numbers don't lie. People do. And I know I locked the door. I know I turned on the alarm, which means Zelman was in this house before I came in. He was lying about being in the field. Finally, Agent Zelman was lying about his identity, pretending not to be Barry, but the man trying to catch him. And now I know that Barry is actually Ward Harlow, the fourth boy on that ledge when Rudy Benton fell to his death. I don't know much more beyond that, but that's still a lot. It was a visceral reaction that became the most important part of my analysis. Yes, it came from years of watching my shows and studying behavior, but also from my mom's theories about men and women and from watching her theories play out around me every day. And it boiled down to this. Why would an FBI agent enlist a teenage girl with a lopsided seesaw to help catch a low-life crime lord? A real FBI agent would never do that. No one would. Now I know exactly who Ward is. I know what he wants and what he thinks of me. But I'm in control, and I have to survive. I make the decisions I had planned to make before my mom came home early from her appointment. "I told you, they're upstairs," I tell Ward. I make sure my voice is shaky. I make sure to tremble, to look weak. And then I say the things that he's expecting me to say as I walk up and he follows behind me, the gun pointed at my back. "Please don't kill me. I'll give you everything. And I won't tell anyone. I promise. I'll never tell a living soul." Ward doesn't say a word as we reach the top step and walk to the left and open the door to my bedroom. "No tricks," he says when I lead him inside. I think of that moment when we drove away from that house where my grandparents were left standing on that lawn. We drove away so they couldn't hurt us anymore, and it didn't matter what came next. Sometimes it all comes down to one choice. And I realize that my mom has been preparing me for this moment my entire life, even if I didn't know it. I open my closet door, but then I turn back to look at him. "Promise you won't kill me," I say again. Ward's face softens.
"I don't want to hurt you. I just want my things, and then I'll be on my way." He says it again. "I won't hurt you if you just give me what I want."
And I remember the first rule I ever made, which is rule number one. If someone says the same thing over and over again, that means they don't believe it. He holds the gun and stands a few feet back. I reach for my teddy bear and pull it from the shelf. I open the back compartment where I hid Coop's cell phone. But this time, I pull out a folded piece of paper with the number written on it, which I had put in the teddy bear as soon as I came home after finding Daryl Romanski dead. "This is what I found in the safe," I tell him. I hand that to him, and I can see that he is hopeful now. that he will get the number and then he can kill me and then blow out of this crumbling shitty town and find another shitty town and no one will ever know he was even here. Then I turn back to the closet and reach into the pocket of a ski parka hanging way in the back. I pull out a cell phone that looks just like Coop's, but it's not. It's one I bought at a convenience store the day I hid the real one. I hand it to Ward and watch as he tucks his gun under his right arm. He needs both hands to check the phone. Ward stands behind me with his gun under his arm while he flips it open. He checks to make sure it has the number he wants, the one that isn't a phone number and that will somehow lead him to Coop's hiding place. He wants to check it against the paper I gave him from the safe. Of course he does. Trust no one. People are easily distracted. And while Ward flips open the phone and powers it on and begins to scroll through the contacts and notes and other apps to see where the number might be, I reach back into the closet. There was also money in the safe. It's here, I tell him. But there's no money in my closet. Just Dusty's old pistol, which I pull out with my right hand just as Ward begins to smile because he sees the number in the memo app. I flip off the safety with my thumb. I've practiced this 100 times, so I do it easily, quickly. I turn, I point. Ward looks up because one part of his brain has captured the image of me standing there, not with the money or a bag that could be holding it, but with a gun, and it sends an alarm to another part of his brain, which then causes his mouth to gape open and his hands to drop the cell phone and reach for the handle of his gun still tucked under his arm. But all of this happens too slowly, because I don't hesitate for one single second before shooting Ward in the chest. Chapter 39, The Night of the Murder. The sound of a skull cracking is unmistakable. I had never heard that before. And yet, as I crouched beneath the service counter in the dining area of the Triple S, I knew what it was instantly. That was the sound that made me wince and cover my ears, and that kept me from being the suspect in Coop's murder. It was that look that was just as unmistakable as the sound of the tomato slicer crushing Coop's skull. I stayed there, under the counter, until I heard the killer go out the back door, and then saw the headlights of a car leave the parking lot and travel down Highway 65 as fast as it could possibly go. That was when I crawled to the side of the entrance to the service area and peeked around the corner and then moved into the service area. And finally, I disappeared from the camera sight, the camera I didn't know was there until the next day. I didn't see Coop's body until I was clear of the center island where we make the sandwiches. It's tall, and we pile things on top of it, like the containers with the oil and vinegar, and the boxes of gloves and other things that don't need to go in the refrigeration units for the night. And when I did see his body, I stood in place for a long time. Maybe 30 seconds, maybe 5 minutes. I have no idea. It felt long. But when you're looking at a dead body, time loses its normal calibration. He was bent over the metal table, face to the side, and looking straight at me with open eyes, his arms stretched out wide. He looked like a robot, like someone had unplugged him and put him away for the night, butt in the air, arms limp across the table. It was just the blood that gave away the fact that he was human. And then what to do? I can't say what drove me to my decision. I can only say that I felt like those boys in Lord of the Flies, which we read in 7th grade. My plane had crashed and I was on a deserted island. No one to help me decide what to do. No rules to follow. Because as far as I knew, no one had any idea where I was when Clay Cooper was murdered.
In that moment of truth about who I was and what I had just become when that plane crashed, these were my thoughts. There were 5 people who wanted Coop dead. Keller, Levi, Janice, Nora, and now Ian. Any one of them could have been fighting him. Any one of them could have swung that tomato slicer at his head. Maybe in self-defense. Maybe it was an accident. Maybe it was deliberate. But none of that mattered to me. What mattered was that I cared about all 5 of those people. I cared about them more than I cared about right and wrong, more than justice, more than the trouble I could get in for cleaning up after them. Each of them would be a suspect, and I ran through the evidence in my mind. Keller, with the bruises and all the times people saw Coop leering at her and rubbing up against her and brushing his hand across her butt when he had more than enough room to pass by her, and she was with him that very night at the Marriott. Upset, running away with no shoes. Her alibi? She was alone with her grandmother. Her senile grandmother. Janice. A lot of people around town knew about him calling her son Halfpint and her husband Shane getting in a fight with him and getting fired. And then Janice having to beg to get the job back because they couldn't survive without it. And then there was that huge fight earlier that night. And what about Shane? He'd already taken a swing at Coop before, lost his pride and then his dignity when his wife had to grovel on his behalf. They would be home together, each other's only alibi, and what good would that be? Levi. Ian knew he wanted to beat Coop to a pulp, and no one knew where he was at the time of Coop's murder. He had no alibi at all, and texts between him and Keller could be even more damning. Nora. Coop had compromised her integrity and made her lie for him every time she had to sign off on documents about the sales and inventory. Maybe she'd had enough and lost it, picked up that slicer and smashed it against his head. I didn't know where she was that night after her potluck dinner, but I assumed she was home alone. Alone was a bad alibi if there ever was one. Ian. Coop had killed his father, and I still had no idea where he was. Maybe he hung up because he was here, pulling into the parking lot while I was in the bathroom. Just like Levi, he had no alibi at all, not even a bad one. And finally, me. I was here. Keller knew I was out looking for Coop. I thought about what I might have done if he tried to stop me from leaving. If someone hadn't killed him first and he was not in the mood for staying within the lines he'd drawn for himself. Yes, I knew. I would have killed him without a second thought. Any and all of us could have done it if the circumstances had been right. 5 people I love, plus myself. And I wanted to get out of here. That was when I knew. I had to protect my tribe. I had to keep them all safe. In that moment, I had to be smart and strategic and think like my life and the lives of everyone I loved depended on it. It was good to be me that night, to have my rules and memories of everything I had ever learned about people. It was strange, but I felt nothing about Coop being dead. It was not hard to detach, to make calculations, and to work the way I work every day when I arrive at the back door and say what I say as I prepare for the chaos. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. It took hours to move Coop's body and clean the store. The details are gruesome, but I was not allowing myself to feel anything. Just thinking. I put on a pair of gloves from the box on the shelf above the counter. I packed the hole in Coop's head with sliced steak until it stopped bleeding. I know that's disgusting, but the wound needed pressure and meat was pliable enough to shove in there. Then I wrapped it tight, round and round, with the industrial-sized plastic wrap that hangs from a dispenser on the wall above the table where his body lay.
I was careful not to get any blood on the dispenser because it's cardboard and it would soak in and not wash off later. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. When the bleeding was contained, I took Coop's keys from his pocket and went to the pickup truck. I backed it right up to the door and opened the hatch to the flatbed. He had a tarp in the back, which he used to wrap the animals he killed on his hunts before putting them into the metal container. I brought it inside and lay it on the floor, and then I pushed his body until it slid off the table and fell onto the tarp. I wrapped it up. I bound it tight with packing tape. Then I dragged it to the back door. Trucks like Coop's that are used to help kill animals have all kinds of useful things, like a lift off the back that goes up and down with the push of a button. Flip it to down and push, and a metal step slowly moves to the ground. Roll the thing that's dead, in this case Coop, onto the step, flip the switch to up, and then press the button, and the step lifts the dead thing up to the height of the flatbed. I rolled Coop, wrapped in the tarp, into the metal container, and closed it shut. Then I put the truck back where it was and went inside to clean. Janice was the one who told us to order the special bleach. I used the bucket and mop and sponges and towels. I didn't wipe anything down that didn't have blood because there had to be fingerprints, and lots of them, too clean, and they'd know someone wiped the place down. All of ours and all of the delivery people and so many that they would never find the killers, even if they tried. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. I closed the store. I put my bike in the back seat of the truck because I know there are cameras all over town, and the last thing I needed was for someone to see my bike in Coop's truck if anyone bothered to look. As it turns out, I managed to avoid the places where the cameras are, but it's better to be safe than sorry in a situation like that. I drove him to his street and dumped his body, then put the keys back in the ignition. I left him by the mailbox, so maybe they would think someone had ambushed him right outside his home. I took the tarp and the plastic wrap and the steak and the tomato slicer and put them in a garbage bag I'd brought from the store. We had 3 slicers, but I doubted anyone else knew this because I do the inventory. I wiped down everything I had touched, and then I rode my bike with the bag tied on me like a backpack to a dump site a few miles from the edge of town and tossed the garbage bag into the pile of other bags and junk people had discarded. Then I went home. I changed my clothes, then washed the old ones, dried them, and folded them neatly, and put them in the back of my closet. Next, I went to take a shower. The same words were still playing over and over in my head. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. Lettuce,